Welcome to Voices of Resilience, a special series from the Vital Voices podcast, where we're sharing stories of courage, commitment, innovation, and perseverance from women leaders in unprecedented crisis. I'm your host, Elise Nelson.
Today, I'm humbled and really excited to speak with world-renowned race car driver, Renee Brinkerhoff. Renee and her team at Valkyrie Racing have a goal to race an iconic 1956 Porsche 356A on all seven continents, including Antarctica, at some of the world's most dangerous and competitive races, all to raise funds and awareness around an issue very near and dear to our heart, human trafficking, in particular, child trafficking. She's shattered records, she's broken barriers in racing and beyond. And today she's here to speak with us about her extremely unique journey and the road that lies ahead. Renee, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Elise, I am so honored to be here with you and your audience. I'm really looking forward to this interview.
Well, absolutely. And we will definitely have a great time and a great conversation. We met just recently, and I think what was exciting to me about sharing your story with our larger network is that right now, you know, as we are navigating this really new world, things have changed rapidly in terms of the way that we interact, in terms of the way that we communicate. We've, you know, for those of us who have been able to social distance, we've been, you know, doing a lot of sort of more solitude and deep thinking. And I think it's a time for reinvention. And it's one of the reasons that I was excited about sharing your story, because at its core, it was about reinvention. It was about seizing a dream that you had had. But I would love for you to tell the story of that journey.
Okay, let's see. I met my husband when I was in college. He had just graduated, started working for an accounting firm at the ground level. And we got married. I was still in college, and I was aspiring to be a surgeon, a neurosurgeon or some type of surgeon. I wanted to go into the medical field. But shortly after getting married, I was pregnant with our first child. And my life just totally changed. And I had to reevaluate what I wanted to do and everything. And at that point, a lot of women had opportunities that we hadn't had before. It was this period in time when it was, you know, a lot of people still stayed home and were moms, and other people were going out and working. It was right at that moment when you had to, it was a really big decision. It was that time. And I loved being a mom. And so it was very, very difficult for me to give up that pursuit. My friends were choosing a professional career, and even for years after I decided to stay at home, it was always so hard. I thought, what if, should I have, and everything. But I loved the role of mom, because for me, being mom was taking this person, this little person, and having this amazing opportunity to grow and help develop this life, to become an amazing citizen of the world, to develop their strengths, find their weaknesses, and help them to grow those and change those into strengths. And I just felt there was, you know, it's that old saying, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. And so I ended up having four kids. And for me, being mom was also being their teacher. So at 2.5 years old, they were learning to read, they were doing math, and they were just having all these amazing experiences. And so we tried to segue into school, and it was a little difficult. And at the same time, as women were having opportunities for, you know, employment, like opportunities in real employment and opportunities to be professionals, homeschooling was a movement that was starting. And it was the very grassroots of that. And I said, I would never, ever, ever do that. I thought, that's for weirdos, excuse me. But that's what I thought, you know, it was such a bizarre thought. But it was a necessity that ended up, that I got to try this, because our son is, our oldest was really advanced. He wasn't able to be with his age group in school. They were putting him with all different classrooms to address his academic needs. And it was not a good environment for him. So I said, okay, I'll try this homeschooling thing. And so that's how that whole thing started. I ended up homeschooling. We had four children, two boys, two girls. I ended up homeschooling all of them. We networked with other parents that were doing that. And a lot of you have had to become homeschooling parents because of COVID lately. And my hats go off with you. I can't imagine it's super difficult, even if you know you've made that decision and you have time to prepare. I can't imagine what it's like for those that haven't had that opportunity to actually, you know, make the decision and then prepare for it. So I ended up homeschooling our kids through high school, most of them through high school, and they all went off to college. They got academic scholarships. They went to competitive schools. And that was this journey that I was on. And, you know, without realizing it, I was being super mom. I was endeavoring to be super mom, you know, the soccer coach, and they were taking music lessons and athletics. It was all those things. And in that whole process, there wasn't time for me to pursue any of my own personal interests. It was either I go be with my girlfriends when they called me for lunch, or, and the kids have to miss their math and their, you know, creative writing and everything else. So I just had to make the decisions to be responsible about their education. I took it so seriously. And so when they had finished and we're all up in college, I was literally in my laundry room folding clothes. I heard this voice in my head, and it was, one day I'm going to race a car. I realized at that moment in time that I had been saying that for 30 some years. And I can't tell you why I was saying that, why it was race a car or anything about that. I think it just had to be a big thing, like a wild beyond the imagination kind of thing. So, because it was tough to not have personal time and to have personal pursuits. And that was like this little star in the sky for me, that kind of thing. But I heard that voice and I wasn't happy. I heard that voice and I realized, oh great, now I have to go do this. And so that's how, for me, racing started. And I was around 56 years old when I heard myself saying this. And it wasn't a happy moment. I wasn't a happy camper. It was a have to, not a want to. But through all that, and, you know, facing immense fears of failure, fears of what people think, etc., I experienced a whole metamorphosis. I call it a rebirth in a sense. So yes, it was, as you said, it was this whole change. And my family, you know, oh my gosh, who's my mom? I didn't know anything. I didn't know this whole other side of her. So that's how it got started. And that was around 2012, 2013. And here we are now, 7 years later.
Wow. So how does one train to be a race car driver?
Wow. That's a good question. You know, it's, for me, it was really difficult because the kind of racing that I chose is what's called rally racing. So rally racing is when you go out on public roads, open roads. They could be dirt roads, they can be tarmac roads, and you just go as fast as you can. You have a navigator sitting next to you who calls your turns. So you are driving what you're seeing, but you're also preparing to drive everything that you don't see. So what's ahead? How tight those turns are, when you're going to brake, how fast you have to go into a corner, and all those things. And you really can't train, because where do you go anywhere where you can go on some open road that has, you know, traffic, right? And people and cars and all these things and police and everything, and go flat out and train. So the only way really was to go down and do racing, to do the race. In fact, my first race, that's what I told the people that had gone down with me, my navigator and my mechanics, was I will have to learn by doing this race. There was really no opportunity, at least not in the United States. And, you know, you can go on a track and get to know your car a little bit, but my car was always being prepared. It was, you had to do all these things to it. And so I never really had much time on the track. So for me, it was learning to race by just jumping into the deep end and having to swim.
Now, what was the first race?
My first race was in Mexico. It's a historic race, started in 1950. It's called the La Carrera Panamericana. It's 7 days, 2,000 miles. You race throughout Mexico, through many different states through Mexico. And they close down the roads, and there's not supposed to be traffic, but sometimes there is. You still have animals, you have cows and dogs and motorcycles and things that still are out there. And you just go flat out. It's as fast as you dare. It's a, you know, what's your tolerance for risk? And if you want to be successful, you can do it a lot of different ways. But if you want to be competitive and successful, you know, you have to go out there and take risk. And we ended up in my first race to make history in the event. For that race, since the 1950s, there had never been a woman that had gone out and in her own car and to win. And then we went back and did that.
So wait, you won?
We won our class. There's the overall, right, winner of like the fastest cars, which are six, let's say 600 horsepower. My car is maybe 110 horsepower, right? So there's no way I can beat those cars. But they have classes within the event that you race with cars that are similar to yours, same horsepower, et cetera. And within my class, we won that year. And they wow. even announced it, you know, history in this race, a woman driver. And typically we're the only woman driven team, and there can be anywhere between 70 to 100 competitors. And most of the time we're the only car that's driven by a woman, and we've podiumed every time we've gone. You know, I get the honor of being on the podium, but it's my, and with my navigator, but it's the whole team thing. You've got to have great mechanics. You have to, you know, my family is super supportive, and it's that whole team thing that gets you there. And so we've either placed first or second every year we've competed. And it was, the La Carrera Panamericana was my first race.
So I should mention, you are also a very beautiful woman. You have long, beautiful blonde hair. I can imagine you show up. And I've seen the photos of you in your full gear with your car. I mean, I would imagine jaws drop.
Well, definitely an anomaly. And of course, because I'm also older, right? Who does this in their 50s, and what woman does this in her 50s? And now I'm, 64, I guess. But I must say, I've never ever felt like I'm a woman. I'm always just a driver. They never make that distinction. I never feel that. Now, I have had that feeling when I was maybe in Australia, or when I was doing events with a lot of people, you know, from the UK or the United States or something like that. But, you know, I never look at myself as a woman driver. I think of myself, I'm a driver. I'm not a woman here. I'm a driver. And we're here doing this event as drivers. And we do stand out. In Tasmania, we were one of 300 teams that was, you know, had a car driven by a woman. So that we definitely stand out. And I, for me, being feminine and being a woman is, you know, I think it's important. I still dress, you know, I put my dress on, I've got my heels on. I love doing that. I love being a woman and being feminine in all this, even though it's a very male sport. I think it's, for me, it's a wonderful thing to be able to be there and represent women.
So you have now completed 6 of these 7 races on each continent. Is that right?
That's correct.
Wow. So obviously COVID has probably slowed some things down. Your last race will be in Antarctica?
That's correct. Yep. So we started the Project 356 World Rally Tour after we'd had the success in Mexico. We wanted to take our platform and have a global voice and have a global message and impact. And so we have been racing the car on every continent. We have one left, and it's in Antarctica. We're slated to be there in January unless COVID rears its head again and we aren't able to travel or something. It, you know, shipping has definitely been slowed down, you know, so we go on a ship in a cargo container, and that's all been delayed. So the logistics have changed a lot, but we're still pushing ahead. And then also in the development of the car, getting parts and metals and things that maybe used to come from China and now we can't get, or trying to source things from different places have created a lot of hurdles. But we're just going on and pushing ahead, and you know, aiming to be there in January.
So at Vital Voices, we are firm believers that leadership is all about seeking power to empower, using your power to empower others and the issues that you care about. From, I know very early on, you wanted this not only to be really a personal pursuit, but, and a family pursuit, I should say, because your family is incredibly engaged, but also really a pursuit for a better world. And I wonder, how did you come across the issue of human trafficking and decide that that has got to be the issue that you take on?
Well, Elise, human trafficking, and in particular child trafficking, which is the part of all that we focus on, is, it found me, it found us. And I say, yes, I work with my daughter, Christina. I have the pleasure and honor to be with her. And the two of us are Valkyrie Racing and Valkyrie Gibbs. So we started Valkyrie Racing, excuse me, we started Valkyrie Gives to address the issue of child trafficking in the world. And I was on a tour bus and sitting in my seat. Everyone had just piled on. I didn't know anybody. And I looked over across the aisle and introduced myself, spoke to the gentleman, and he was with his fiance, and we were chatting, and he began, you know, we asked him, well, what do you do? Where you're from? And he told me he worked for the FBI, that he lives in Florida, and that he's involved in the FBI unit that seeks out and prosecutes people that are producing and selling child pornography. And I had no idea of the industry and how massive it is, and that it's really, a lot of it's going on in the United States. I was totally unaware of this. And so I talked to him, and we had follow-up conversations and email with each other and learn more and more about it. And then I learned that child pornography fuels a lot of child trafficking. The people that are watching those things then have to act out, and how do they have to get kids. So they go, you know, and then I learned about child trafficking, and also then about, I don't know, maybe 6 months, within a year after I'd met this man in the FBI, I was sitting down on a Hertz bus going to the lot to get a rental car. I sat down to this man, and he had his phone open, and you just glance over at the person next to you. And I just looked, you know, quickly at his phone screen, and there was a pornographic image of a child. Oh. And I said to myself, what is going on here? Something is going on here. So I've already had my heart tugged on. I've been aware of this issue, and now this is happening again. And I don't believe in coincidences. And I really felt like I need to do something about this. This issue, this problem, this travesty is seeking me out, and I'm supposed to do something about it. So that's how it started. You know, up until then, we were doing things for impoverished women and children in Mexico, and we would go down racing. And then we realized, you know, we really want to focus whatever we do on helping kids that are being trafficked. And that's when, you know, the Project 356 was developed, and to have an impact across the world, to put out the message, to bring awareness, donate money in countries where we're racing, to support the grassroots works and organizations that are doing something for prevention and rescue and rehabilitation. And so all this came together. We just realized, let's have a bigger voice. Let's create this global platform to have a bigger world impact. And that's, you know, how it just was. I just know it was meant to be. It was something that we're supposed to be doing, and that's what we're doing.
I believe in that so much. And, you know, Vital Voice is one of the things we talk about as a driving force, you know, a real sense of mission. And, you know, when I think about you, I mean, you're driving change, right? That's what you're doing. I mean, you're a driver, but you are using the power that gives you, and the platform that gives you, to drive change in the lives of children. And I think it's incredibly powerful. So I hope you recognize that. And I would imagine very inspiring for people listening. And I would love to know, just when you think about your life pre-racing and your life now, what has changed in you? How are you different?
Oh, wow. You know, I know what I've experienced that's different. And it's interesting to hear, you know, like sometime to ask my family what, because they came to know me and I came to know myself. So when I got married and I was really young and I started that family, and then my whole focus was what's best for our kids, you know, let those children. My whole personal growth, I believe, pretty much stopped. You know, I developed my intellect and my abilities as a teacher and an administrator of our school and everything. But all this inward stuff stopped, and I was very shy. I was very insecure. I couldn't have been doing this program without probably perspiring and shaking. It just totally gave me confidence. Because I had to face so many fears, literally, like my body would be shaking at the start of a race. Uncontrollably, I was so frightened. I'd be praying every morning on my knees in the hotel room on the floor, you know. There was so much that happened to me, and I found out who I was. I found out who I'm not. I found in my strengths, I found my weaknesses, and I had to develop skills I didn't have. I mean, so much has happened to me personally. And then this whole thing of having this heart for people and children all along, and then being able to have this focus and be able to make a difference with kids that are being trafficked and be involved in doing rescue and getting evidence for the police and then speaking to people about it. I never, ever thought I would be where I am today. Never in my wildest imagination would I be doing what I'm doing now. It was beyond anything I could have imagined. And then to be involved with my daughter and have this experience with her. And then I got to race with my other daughter for the first time in Africa last year, and having that experience. It's been, I'm so thankful. I'm so thankful that I listened to that voice and I made myself go do it. And I'm so thankful that I'm where I am and I have this opportunity. It's, I feel so blessed.
Mm. I think it's also such an important lesson because not everyone listens. Most people do not listen to that voice. And I'm a big believer in, you know, the world or, you know, the God that you believe in will bring you and tell you and gesture you and show you what you need to see to take the action that you are meant to take. But it's all about, are you going to hear it? Are you going to listen? So I'm a huge believer in that. And I love stories like this and, you know, incredible life pursuits like this. You mentioned your family earlier, and I'm so excited that we have your daughter, Christina, here. And Christina, I just want to bring you into the conversation. So, you know, your mom announces to the family, this is something that she's going to do. What was the response? And how do you think your mom has changed as a result of this path that she's been on the last 8 years?
Yeah.
About 8 years.
That's a good question. I've seen my first response, I'd have to say, is that even though my mom sort of wasn't living her fullest life, if you will, she sort of she's always been who she is. So I don't remember being completely shocked. I mean, it was a surprise. It was like, what? But I think we sort of had no idea what she was really saying, right? Until you go down to that race and you go, oh my goodness, it's like nothing you've ever seen before. So, and I went down on her first race and had that experience, and I had no idea what she had gotten herself into, and was awed by that. But I think in terms of what I've seen my mom have a complete metamorphosis. It feels a full life transformation. And for me, being her daughter and just being a woman, seeing makes me reflect a lot on my own life and what I want to do with it, because I've seen her become who she is. And in so many ways, I feel like I didn't really know. I was 24, 25 when my mom started doing this. And I feel like I didn't really know her for the first 24 years. Because I think she finally became her fullest part of herself, right? She was able to sort of direct her life in a way that made a lot of sense. And it was such a gift to be able to see that. It's been one of the coolest things, I think, from this whole thing is watching. I've never seen anybody have a complete life metamorphosis. So seeing that has been so special and really inspiring.
It is beautiful and so lovely to hear about it from a daughter's perspective. I feel like we so rarely get to hear that. So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think so many people, as I mentioned before, you know, all of us, you know, dealing with this global pandemic and, you know, the sort of resurge and, you know, the economy is just in dire straits and the, you know, unemployment rates through the roof, whether people have lost jobs and are trying to figure out what's next, or this experience has rocked them. Maybe they've lost someone who's close to them, or maybe it's just rocked them because it's total sheer change. And they're reevaluating their life, right? And I think as much as this is an incredibly difficult time and there is so much pain and suffering, if we could see any silver lining, it is that, you know, it gives us a different perspective. And I think for people who want to have greater purpose in their life and give back, hopefully it propels them forward to be able to do that. And I just wonder, Renee, from your perspective, what advice do you have for people who maybe you're listening and are thinking, like, I want a metamorphosis, you know, I want to do something. And And I think, you know, obviously, you know, what you did was on a massive scale, and I would imagine you had to, you know, raise the funds to even begin to do it. But how do people just even take that really scary step, you know, off the cliff to say, I'm gonna live that dream I've had for so long?
Mm-hmm. Well, I totally believe and would attest to the importance, the necessity to get out of your comfort zone. You have to get out of your comfort zone to find out what your limitations are and to even address those limitations and have change. And it can be the smallest thing. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be this thing that I ended up doing. It can be something so small as, you know, I've always wanted to do X. What is X? You know, have a bakery, go volunteer here, lead a book club, do speaking on something I care about. I mean, it doesn't matter how big or small it is. The thing is to do what, first of all, listen to your voice. And if there's not like a voice in your head, then what do you have a passion about something and go out and try things. But most importantly, get out of your comfort zone. And if you're afraid of something, go do it. All the more reason to go do it. I really firmly believe you have to face your fears. Face those fears. Do not let fear, even fear of COVID, it becomes paralyzing to people. But really, you can. There's so many opportunities right now, and you have to not be afraid. Do not be afraid. And address your fears. Face your fears. Tackle those fears. For me, prayer, my belief in God is integral for me in all of that. But you cannot live in fear, and you cannot let fear or what people think. That's the other thing. Not just like fear of failure, but fear of what people think. Think about you, what they're going to think, whether you succeed, whether you fail, whether you go try something. There's so many different kinds of fear that presents itself in so many different ways. And not to let any of those things stop you. Don't let the naysayers stop you, the people that say, oh, you can't do that or you shouldn't do that. Do not limit yourself with your own limitations and expectations or somebody else's. So, and all of that will get you out of your comfort zone. And then you will have metamorphosis. You will have change. And your heart grows. Everything about you grows in this wonderfully beautiful way. And so especially now, like with COVID and again, with the fear people have, it's all the more important that we are not ruled by that fear.
And it's such an important lesson for right now. And if people want to learn more and support your effort, what do they do? They go to your website.
Yeah,
how do they get engaged?
We would love you to follow in our journey and to find out who we are, what we're doing. You can go to our website, valkyrieracing.com, valkyrieracing.com. You can donate. And we can't do anything without money. How can you affect change? Takes a voice and it takes money to go out and have an effect, whether it's to educate children. We had the opportunity to go to Quechua, the Quechua children. And we were able to speak to hundreds of children there to teach them about things that prevent them from being victims of child trafficking. All those things, all of the money for racing is separate. All the money for administrating Valkyrie Gives is paid for by Valkyrie Racing. Every dollar we get goes directly 100% to a grassroots organization. We spend extensive amount of time vetting the people that get that money to make sure they're doing honest, good, profitable, successful work. And it's almost always grassroots organization because they're in the country, they work with local law enforcement, they work with the schools and the infrastructure within their own company. And those are their children, those are their people. They have that passion and they're doing the majority of the work and they're getting the most minimal funds that are out there. And this whole thing, all the money that's being spent on human trafficking, they're the ones that get the least amount. So go to our website and learn about us, email us, call us. If you have questions, we welcome you to join us, to partner with us. And we have a drive, donate 356. If we get 2,000, I think like 227 people or something that would give $356, we could make our goal of $1 million. We've raised about 220,000 so far. And we're designating now who is going to get those funds and where we can have the biggest impact. So that's what we're doing. And we welcome you to come and join us to make a difference. We have to join together to make a difference. It's impossible otherwise. And you know that, Elise. It takes all of us. It takes every one of us. So yeah, that's the best way is go to our website.
Renee, thank you so much. And Christina, thank you so much as well to both of you, phenomenal women who really inspired us today. So thank you. And good luck to you with that final race in Antarctica. I hope it does work out. And I hope we can follow you. And I know we'll find more ways to work together in the future. So thank you so very much.
Thanks for listening to the special edition of the Vital Voices podcast. We hope that you're doing all you can to keep yourselves, your families, your teams, and your communities safe and healthy. If you'd like to support our work with women leaders in this country and around the world, you can donate to Vital Voices on our website at vitalvoices.org. Or you can text VITAL, V-I-T-A-L, to 41444. That's VITAL to 41444. Stay safe and remember that we will get through this unsettling time together.